7BR Pot Herd.
Hello, and welcome to 7BR's Pot Herd, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Rhys Palmer, Chambers Paralegal. I welcome back one of our regular guests to the podcast, Elaine Banton, who's here today to discuss another judgment handed down by the Supreme Court, the case of Royal Mencap Society and Tomlinson Blake, and the joint appeal of Shannon and Rampersad. Elaine heads Chambers' employment team. She specialises in employment, equality and discrimination law, and regularly appears in appeals at all levels, representing claimants and respondents in multi-strand discrimination matters and high-value and complex trials. She has previously been on Part Heard to discuss positive action and 10 years of the Equality Act, and more recently, the Supreme Court decision on the workers' rights appeal, Uber and Aslam. Elaine, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Rhys. Happy to be here.
As I was saying, we're back again to discuss another judgment handed down by the Supreme Court, that of Royal Mencap Society and Tomlinson Blake. Before we delve into what the judgment means for sleeping workers and the national minimum wage, could you just perhaps give us a brief background to the matter?
Yes. In each case of Royal Mencap and Rampersad, the issue was how the hours of the sleeping shift should be calculated for the purposes of the national minimum wage. It had been thought that following early decisions such as British Nursing, that a worker could be working even if they were not required to be actually awake if a need arose during a sleep-in shift, for example. Now, the history of the cases are like this. Mrs. Tomlinson Blake was a highly qualified care support worker. She provided daycare, for which she was salaried for the purposes of the regulation. She also provided sleeping shifts for specified hours, which is time work within the meaning of the regulations. She was permitted to sleep during this period, but was required to remain at the home of two vulnerable adults for whom she cared throughout her sleeping shift. But she had no duties to perform during the night, except, as she put it, to keep a listening ear out even while asleep, a formidable task. She effectively had to attend to any emergency if there was one, so needed to hear to be able to respond. According to the evidence, she had been disturbed only about six times in the period of 16 months leading up to the Employment Tribunal hearing. She received an allowance of £23.35 plus 1 hour's pay of £6.70 in recognition of the reasonable expectation of the amount of work she would have to do during her sleeping shift, which was a total of £29.05. Her case turned on the 2015 regulations. The Rampersad case concerned Mr. Shannon, who was an on-call night care assistant at a registered residential care home. From 1993, he enjoyed free accommodation at the home with all utilities provided, free of charge, together with a payment of £50 a week, which rose to £90. It was a condition of his employment that he was in that accommodation from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m, but was permitted to sleep during that period. The night care worker on duty could call him on assistance during those hours. Mr. Shannon contended that he should have been paid National Minimum Wage, NMW, for all the nighttime hours that he was required to be on call. But in practice, he was very rarely called upon to assist the night care worker. And from the 1st of January 2014, he was dismissed, and he brought proceedings, among other reasons, to recover arrears of salary, which by reason of his alleged entitlement to NMW, he stated amounted to almost £240,000. Mr. Shannon relied on the 1999 regulations, as the 2015 regulations were not in force at the time of his dismissal. In Royal Mencap, the claimant succeeded in both the ET and the EAT. The Employment Tribunal judge determined the preliminary issue in her favour, holding that during the sleeping shift she was performing time work, whether she was awake or not. In the EAT, Lady Justice Simler, then the President, applying a multifactorial test, was satisfied that Mrs. Tomlinson Blake was working throughout the entire shift as she was constantly on call. On that basis, it was not necessary to engage a second stage, which would have been to consider the sleep-in exception. Rampersad followed a different trajectory. Mr. Shannon, in the ET and EAT, had both of his cases dismissed. It was agreed that he was doing salaried hours work, but the Employment Tribunal found as a fact that Mr. Shannon was not working throughout his shift. He simply provided support to the night care worker if required to do so, Therefore, Regulation 16 of the 99 regulations, as amended, applied, and Mr. Shannon's claim failed because his accommodation constituted his home. In the EAT, Judge Peter Clark dismissed his appeal. He held that the Regulation 16 of the 99 regulations, as amended, applied, and that Mr. Shannon could not claim the NMW because of the home and sleep in exceptions. The cases were then heard together in the Court of Appeal. Lord Justice Underhill gave the lead judgment and allowed the appeal in relation to Mrs. Tomlinson Blake and dismissed it in relation to Mr. Channon. Therefore, both of the employees' cases were effectively defeated, with the defences of the employers succeeding in the Court of Appeal. It then went to the Supreme Court.
Thank you for that, Elaine. Now, before we go into the arguments that each party put forward, could you just perhaps explain to us what a sleep-in worker is in relation to the National Minimum Wage and why that definition was so important in this judgment?
Yes. So carers are among those who may have to work sleep-in shifts, i.e. shifts when they have to be at or near their place of work, but during which they may, with the permission of their employer, sleep for some or all of that time. Such workers who may sleep during their shifts are sleep-in workers. Regulation 15 provides in relation to a worker who by arrangement sleeps at or near a place of work and is provided with suitable facilities for sleeping, time during the hours she's permitted to use those facilities for the purpose of sleeping shall only be treated as time work when the worker is awake for the purpose of working. So a crucial question for an employer to whom the NMWA 1998 applies is whether the remuneration that he is paying to his workers is at least equal to the national minimum wage. Because if it is not, he or she may be liable to pay arrears and financial or criminal penalties. The current statutory low pay commission was established pursuant to Section 8 of the NMWA 1998, and it has an authoritative and influential role in the setting of the NMW. The first report of the low pay commission was presented to Parliament in June 1998. It contained a specific recommendation in relation to sleep-in shifts. The LPC recommended as the starting point for defining working time generally as all time which a worker had to spend at his employer's place of work, even if no work was available. But this would not include time which a worker had to spend at some other place on standby or on call. But then specifically in relation to the sleep-in situation, the Low Pay Commission recommended that for hours when workers are paid to sleep on their premises, we recommend that workers and employers should agree their allowance as they do now, but workers should be entitled to the NMW for all times when they are awake and required to be available for work. So we can see that the LPC, the Low Pay Commission, had not intended that anyone who was permitted to sleep could be deemed working or engaged in time work when the LPC were first reported to the government prior to the regulations coming into effect.
So this is what Mrs. Tomlinson Blake and Mr. Shannon were arguing in their claims, isn't it? That they should be paid the national minimum wage for their entire night shift as a sleep-in worker.
Yeah.
So what sort of arguments were they putting forward to support that?
Well, this is quite interesting. You're right. They were both claiming that they were entitled to NMW for the entire night shift as sleeping workers. And they put forward similar arguments. For Mrs. Tomlinson Blake, it was argued that on the facts as found by the Employment Tribunal, she was working and not simply available for work for the purposes of Regulation 32 of the 2015 regulations. And even when Mrs. Tomlinson Blake had to, even when she was asleep, she had to have that listening ear. But this was not successful, as we know. The other argument that was put forward was that by performing the sleep-in shift, Mrs. Tomlinson Blake enabled MenCap to perform its contractual obligations to the local authority which in turn was thereby able to discharge its statutory obligations. And also that by the configuration of her shifts and the fact that she did these sleeping shifts and day shifts as well, it was more economical for her employer to configure it in that way. Now, with Shannon, the arguments for Mr. Shannon were very similar as well. They were saying that he was working by merely being present. And they also made the same point that the worker, by being there and doing the night shift, was enabling the employer to perform an important regulatory duty that should be a factor weighing in favour of the worker performing work and not just being available for work. So they had similar arguments, effectively.
And in response, Royal Mencap and Clifton House, what were they arguing?
Well, yes, both Royal Mencap and Clifton House were effectively arguing that a sleeping worker is exempt generally and should only be paid when they are actually awake. They countered that there was nothing in the regulations themselves which would indicate that statutory requirements placed on the employer were a relevant consideration in actually calculating the hours of work for the purposes of NMW. They also argued that the multifactorial test didn't apply. That test, they said, would introduce a considerable amount of uncertainty into the domain of NMW rights of a sleeping worker, and that it would be undesirable and not in the interests of either party to the arrangement. They also argued that this listening ear did not change matters and used the analogy of not being paid for travel time to work and back. And so those were the arguments effectively opposing the claimant's appeals.
And you've already touched upon this. You said the Court of Appeal dismissed both of the claims, essentially stating that neither were entitled to be paid the national minimum wage for the hours of their sleeping shifts, to which the Supreme Court has unanimously upheld that decision. Could you run us through the reasoning behind the Supreme Court judgment?
Yes. So I think there was some discussion in terms of policy aims, for example, such as the objectives of the NMW as a social and economic measure being complex, but it was clearly there to redress the law of supply and demand where there may be a market failure and the worker is not able to obtain basic recompense for labour. And there were other objectives as well in terms of policy. But I think it was a key factor was to have those minimum standards of pay and to bring about consistency and more certainty in terms of the LPC and the Low Pay Commission. But the reasoning effectively was that the Supreme Court held that for the purposes of deciding whether a person is working under the NMW, it does not matter that a worker is at their employer's discretion or required to follow instructions. The Low Pay Commission had not intended that anyone who was permitted to sleep could be deemed to be working or engaged in time work when they first reported to the government prior to the 1999 version of the regulations. And also that the definition of time work, the phrase awake for the purposes of working, was composite and couldn't be broken up into awake and for the purposes of working. So any time where you were asleep couldn't be time work. The multifactorial test that Lady Justice Singler set out in the EAT to determine whether someone was working simply by being present before deciding whether they were engaged in time work is not required under the NMW and should not be followed. And then if a worker is actually called on to respond to someone's care needs or any other duties when on a shift during the night, that time will count as time work and be subject to the NMW.
So another part of the judgment that I read, and you mentioned one of the cases earlier, British Nursing Association, the Supreme Court stated that they were wrongly decided and should be overruled. Could you just, I guess, perhaps just expand on that a bit and what that now means moving forwards in relation to that?
Yes, there were a few cases that I think it's fair to say have been overruled now by the Supreme Court. You're quite right. One was the British nursing case, and the fundamental feature of that case was that the employment tribunal had held that the employees who were answering telephones were working and not merely available for work throughout their night shifts, even during periods when they were expected to be sleeping and the calls that they answered were infrequent. So that was overruled in the Court of Appeal and in the Supreme Court, as was Burrow Down, the case of Burrow Down Support Services Limited versus Rossiter. That was a case concerning a night sleeper who was present at a care home overnight to ensure security. He could sleep apart from when his duties required him to be awake. He also had to spend 15 minutes reporting at the beginning and end of a shift and to assist serving breakfast. But there was no evidence that he was in fact disturbed during the night. So that was a case that was overruled in the Court of Appeal and in the Supreme Court. And then again, the case of Scotbridge Construction Limited versus Wright, which was a persuasive authority only for the Court of Appeal. But in that case too, the sleeper in was held to be working and outside of the Regulation 15 of the 99 regulations. So those cases were overruled by the Supreme Court.
And moving forward, what does this mean for sleep-in workers and what implications does this have on the sector?
Well, I think the case has a number of far-reaching implications for the sector generally. I would say that the concept of sleeping with a listening ear seems a rather complex and challenging one for anyone. It is also, as we know, a sector which is generally poorly paid in any event, which it would appear has unfortunately become even more poorly paid. So that, I would say, is a concern. We are also presented with the complicated scenarios where you might find in a sleep-in shift, there's part compensation for a shift and other circumstances, it's not compensated. You'll have the splintering up of an 8 or 9 hour sleep-in shift into different fragments of time, which may or may not count for NMW purposes. And I think concern has been expressed that workers' time now has been broken up and work construed rather narrowly at potentially the cost of workers' rights and dignity. There are also some practical concerns. You know, this is going to add to complexity, and also record keeping will be more challenging. But employers may view the compensating higher daily rates that you find in some sectors as less necessary. And I think we are going to see, as I say, more complexities in terms of the record keeping and calculation in terms of shifts. Effectively, the Supreme Court decision following the Court of Appeal permits the non-payment of NMW, for which many would consider to be work here, but it doesn't actually prevent pay settlements in excess of the minimum via negotiations. So there is a challenge for trade unions representing care workers and other workers impacted to seek to negotiate staff terms regarding payment of sleep-in shifts. Decisions like this also show that for some of these issues, possibly thought to be the domain of the gig economy, such working practices actually extend beyond the gig economy and include the public sector and essential frontline services. I'd also say that it seems a little bit out of step with some of the recent strides to afford vulnerable workers with more rights, such as seen in the Uber decision in Supreme Court. Some commentators have also suggested that it possibly highlights a need to amendment to the legislation, but what that would look like would certainly require careful assessment.
Thank you, Elaine. This has once again been an insightful discussion, and your opinions are always very, very well thought through. Thank you to our listeners. If you've enjoyed this week's episode, you can find similar episodes from Elaine and the employment team, where they discuss recent judgments such as Uber and Aslam on Chambers' website. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.